Hi, I'm Paul Eastwick, author of Bonded by Evolution, The New Science of Love and Connection. I'm a professor at UC Davis, and for about 20 years, I've conducted research that attempts to explain how people form and maintain romantic and sexual relationships. What are the factors that pull people together, and what keeps them happy over time? Lessons about attraction and relationships are everywhere, and it can be pretty confusing to know how to make sense of it all. Some theories seem quite appealing on the surface, like the idea that attraction works like a mating market, or that men and women want really different things. There's an evolutionary story here that some find compelling. These ideas, though, are less accurate than is commonly believed. But mine is not the standard nature versus nurture critique. My book, Bonded by Evolution, introduces a new evolutionary theory of human relationships that is much better aligned with the evidence base and more useful for people who want to make their relationships better. Insight number one, the mating market is time-limited. There's this classic concept in evolutionary theories about human mating, and it's called mate value. It's this idea that some people are desirable and some people are not. It's pretty straightforward, and I think to many it seems patently obvious, right? Like, not everybody is equally physically attractive. This is important because, again, classically, mate value mattered because attraction is like a market. There are winners and losers, right? If you're hot, you can land anyone, but if you're not, then you're probably going to have to settle. And this is kind of a bummer, but in this worldview, it's just a sad reality that the tens get the tens and the twos get the twos. This idea is right, but only in a very narrow sense. And the reason why is that mate value assumes that attractiveness is objective. That is, that we all agree about who is hot and who is not. And we do, sometimes, and only sort of. Even when people first meet, there is far more disagreement than agreement. Odds are, at the party, the person that you were super into was not the same person that your friend was super into. And critically, this becomes more and more true over time as people get to know each other. We know this because we can actually track agreement over time in networks of friends and acquaintances as they spend time together. And when you do this, after a few months, people barely agree at all about who is desirable and who is not. Honestly, when we first saw this in the data, we were sort of stunned, but you see it over and over again. And to put numbers on it, if you imagine a group of mixed gender friends and you're just making binary hot or not judgments, if you think someone is hot, the odds that your friend agrees with you is a mere correlation of 0.06, which is a 53% chance that they agree, barely better than a coin flip. That is, it would be very common that you would think she's incredible and your friend thinks, not for me. So the upside here is that when people spend time getting to know each other, odds are that you're going to think someone else is a 10, even if no one else thinks that. And the hope is that this person thinks you're a 10 too, even if the others don't agree. Insight number two, gender differences are overblown. To some folks, when you talk about sexual and romantic relationships, you need to talk about gender. It's long been assumed that men and women are very different. I mean, so different, in fact, that undergraduates may learn about men's and women's preferences in different chapters of the textbook. And now, it's true that many of the more famous and foundational ideas about the evolutionary psychology of mating focused on differences between men and women, but many of those differences don't mean what we think they mean. So here's one you've probably heard before. Women prefer ambitious partners more than men do. Is this statement true? Well, it depends. When scientists started studying this question, they gave people surveys with lists of traits, and people circled some numbers on scales to indicate how much they liked those traits. And in these cases, yes, it's certainly true that women give higher ratings than men on attributes like ambitious or successful. But the thing is that humans didn't evolve to fill out rating scales with lists of traits. We evolved to evaluate real people, people we might want to date or not, some of whom are ambitious and some of whom are not, right? So what we really want to know is, does a partner's ambition make him or her more appealing? This captures what people actually want. Do you pick the ambitious partner instead of the not-so-ambitious one? And we can do studies like this, where we introduce men and women to a bunch of potential romantic partners, like at a speed dating event. Do the women like the ambitious men more than the unambitious ones? Yes, a little. They have a mild preference for ambition in these men. They'd pick the more ambitious man about 60% of the time. But then we look at the men's preferences for the women. Again, some of whom are ambitious and some are not. And it's exactly the same. And I do mean exactly. They're also picking the more ambitious woman about 60% of the time. In other words, ambitious partners are more appealing than unambitious ones. And this is equally true for men and women. And when it comes to what men and women want, we see this pattern over and over again. You might see a difference in what men and women say, but nothing in what men and women actually want. And this isn't just an initial attraction story. We see it in ongoing relationships too. The qualities that make for a happy, attached relationship include things like finding a partner who supports you, who laughs at your jokes, and like we discussed earlier, who you find to be especially physically attractive. And none of those factors differ by gender. Insight number 3, biological determinism is a trap. What do you think of when you hear that a particular human behavior or preference is evolved? A number of studies have shown that people assume that evolved preferences are especially resistant to change. Consider men's greater interest in casual sex. If you tell people this is due to evolution, they're more likely to think, well, I guess there's nothing we can do about that. This belief has a name. It's called biological determinism. If biological determinism were true, it would mean that there are fewer places to intervene between the biological source and the real-world behavior. So when you tell people something has evolved, they think, oh, that's just how it is then, like it's more automatic. This belief is the source of considerable confusion and conflict when it comes to evolutionary psychology. Some people openly endorse forms of determinism, even a lot of scientists. Right, of course, it's evolved, and that explains why we see it in every culture. Other people use the inverse logic. If something were evolved, well, that would mean it's hard to change, which in and of itself feels like a regressive excuse, so evolutionary psychology sucks. This whole line of reasoning is a mess. It's important to resist biologically determinist thinking for two reasons. The first is that biological determinism isn't true in any generalizable or useful way. Yeah, sometimes biological things are hard to change. I mean, ask anyone going through withdrawal symptoms, for example. But sometimes they're easy to change. Humans evolved in a context where we moved long distances every few months. Many of us are now partial to staying put with no negative consequences. Poor eyesight is largely genetic. It's also easy to fix by popping some glasses on your face. And sometimes learned things are really hard to change. For example, there are far better alternatives to the QWERTY keyboard, which is an intentionally bad keyboard arrangement designed to prevent old typewriters from getting jammed, but nobody wants to change it because it would be so hard for all of us to unlearn the way we type. The second reason is that it's the biological determinism that takes reasonable debates about our evolved psychology and turns it into internet toxicity. For example, in the online black pill and incel subcultures, these folks take evolutionary findings to an extreme using determinist logic. For example, men who believe in the black pill believe that a person's attributes are genetically set and cannot be changed. Your mate value is fixed and women are hardwired to detest you. It's the determinism that fosters the misogyny and the rage. So whether you're a fan or a skeptic of evolutionary psychology, don't conflate this preference has evolved with this preference is difficult to change. People are biased to link these things, but doing so is both untrue and dangerous. Insight number 4. Compatibility is crucial, but unpredictable. One of the cardinal rules of close relationships is that compatibility is key. Some pairs work beautifully together, and some are disastrous. And naturally, this is something you'd want to be able to predict, especially if, for example, you are running an app for daters. And in the early days of online dating, this is what people were claiming was possible. Give people some questionnaires, find the compatible ones, put them together, and let the predictable outcomes unfold. But as this science has matured, it's turned out to be far harder to do this than we thought, and the app creators were probably just making things up. So let's take one idea we call similarity matching. The similarity matching idea is straightforward. You've got a set of traits and attributes, values, interests, other things that you like. So if you report those ahead of time, I can do the same thing with a bunch of other potential partners and match you up across all of these different items. The question is, are you more likely to like the people when your match is very strong, when you share a whole bunch of traits, attributes, values, and interests? The reality is, when you look at similarity matching on attraction in this way, the effects are very, very small. We're really no more or less likely to be attracted to people when we share a whole bunch of similarities. Another possible idea is that we want to find people that have the traits that we say are truly essential in a partner. Like, what are your three deal breakers? For you, what does a partner have to have? Well, we can do studies like this too and see, well, are you especially happy with somebody who fits your description? It turns out these effects are pretty small too, so this isn't a great approach either. So maybe the problem was that we can't actually intuit the answers to these things. What if instead we just let the algorithms try to tell us what the best matches are? So we can address this issue using something called machine learning, right? Maybe the pairings are something like, oh, extroverted men work well with anxious women, or avoidant men work with women who are high in openness, right? Who knows? Just let the algorithms tell us, are there some combinations in here that reliably work? So my colleague Samantha Joel conducted a whole bunch of studies and analyses along these lines, and the answer was no. It's not that we can't predict anything using this approach. We can tell you who's popular, for example, but can we use troves of questionnaires to figure out who is going to be compatible with whom? No. So compatibility is key, but we can't explain it with information about two people before they meet. So where does compatibility come from? Well, that brings us to our last insight. Insight number five. A relationship is what you make it. I think we labor under the misimpression that humans do something called mate choice, like I'm shopping for a pair of shoes. And in this analogy, there's a moment where I'm evaluating, and I eventually say, this pair looks good, and I commit, and I make the purchase. I can't begin to express what a bad way this is to think about how relationships take shape. That's not to say that people can't do this, but it's far from typical. The typical process, I think, is better captured by the phrase, that was nice, let's do it again. We had a nice time hanging out at that party. I laughed a lot. When I see you at the bar next week, I'm likely to want to pull up a seat next to you. Now repeat this process 1,000 times. And yes, I'm talking about sex too. In humans, it's shocking the extent to which sex is actually decoupled from reproduction relative to other animals. Even absent modern birth control, humans have sex all the time when conception is not going to happen. Why is this? Well, it's because sex is also part of this testing and retesting process. People do this because bonds have to be built. We have to construct a history together, and that history often takes on a life of its own. It morphs into something that we call the tiny culture of the relationship, the rituals, the patterns, the pet names that people use for each other. And these tiny cultures bring an enormous amount of meaning and joy to people's lives because it's what makes each relationship feel special and wholly unique. Earlier, I mentioned that we aren't actually attracted to people who are similar to us, but what I neglected to mention is that we sure do think similarity matters, but that's not because the traits or values or interests that you reported in advance are crucial. It's because couples tend to lean into the things that they have in common. And what's fascinating about this, these tiny cultures are what give us the sense that similarity matters, right? As you build a relationship, you build it around a few core similarities that you happen to share. But it doesn't really matter what the similarities are. It could be a mutual love of rock climbing or Japanese cinema or music or writing or the ways that your jobs intersect or your local school or any or all of the above. So I think better than any kind of purchasing metaphor to understand relationships, think instead about two kids playing in a sandbox, constructing some sort of structure together without a blueprint and with only a vague idea of where things are headed. And sometimes those structures crumble suddenly, and sometimes they turn out to be truly majestic, and you look at it and say, wow, we built that. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoy my book, Bonded by Evolution.